Welcome to Headlines. This is Ari Wasserman sitting in for David Lichtenstein to introduce our topic of the week. Parshas Bo discusses the Korban Pesach, the Shechita of the Korban Pesach, the eating of the Korban Pesach, the celebration of the Korban Pesach. And in fact, the B'nai Yisachar says that the Korban Pesach represents the triumph of real emuna in HaKadosh Baruch Hu over the pagan beliefs of the meat stream in the lamb. We bring the Korban Pesach from the lamb, which was worshipped by the meat stream. And in fact, this represents the supremacy of belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu over the belief in animals, and specifically in the month of Nisan, whose mazel, whose constellation is Taleh, which is the lamb. And especially during the middle of the month, when it's at its strength, we bring the Korban Pesach. It's eaten on the 15th of the month, right in the middle, when the Taleh is its strongest. We shecht it, we eat it, we celebrate it, and we show that the power of Taleh is useless. And indeed, that is going to be the basis for our discussion today. Meat in Halacha, meat in Hashkafa. Is it permitted, for example, to be a vegetarian or a vegan who decide that they don't want to have meat? Is that finding in favor of the supremacy of meat over the permissibility of the Torah enabling us to eat meat? How about being an animal rights activist? In fact, animal rights activists are causing the problems in Europe right now with bans on Shechita, and we'll discuss those bans and can that spread to the United States as well. Are there times that we're required to eat meat? For example, how about on Shabbos? How about on Yontif? How about at a bris milah? Are there types of meat that we're not permitted to eat? For example, veal. Synthetic meat, is that going to be flesh or is that going to be carved because it was developed in a laboratory? And we'll talk about various aspects of Shechita. Can an Ashkenazi eat meat from a Sfardi Ashkacha and vice versa? And also we'll talk about the aspects of basar shenisal min ha'ayin, leaving meat that has not been supervised. For example, can you leave meat on a barbecue when no one's watching it? Can you leave meat at home with non-Jewish cleaning help? Before we introduce our guests, we will quickly go through the riddle of the week. In Parshas Bo, there's a discussion, obviously, about the Korban Pesach and Pesach in general. And in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Tesvav, it says that not only is the first day a Yontif, but also the seventh day is a Yontif as well. And then it adds on, however, on the seventh day, Shvi Shel Pesach, what is permitted is Ochel Nefesh. Food preparation is permitted, for example, cooking and baking of food, that's permitted, even though it's Yontif. Shabbos is not permitted, but Yontif it's permitted. And the question, the riddle of the week is, why is it taught specifically on Shvi Shel Pesach that Ochel Nefesh is permitted if that applies to all Yontifs? Ochel Nefesh, preparation of food, booking, cooking, baking is permitted on all Yontifs. Why is it taught specifically on the Shvi Shel Pesach? To introduce our guests, we are going to start out with Rabbi Yitzhak Breidowitz, the renowned posek, the Rav of the Kilat Or Sameach. We will then speak with Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt. He is the chief rabbi of Moscow. He is the president of the Conference of European Rabbis, who are dealing with the various bans on Shechita throughout Europe and also spreading to Bris Milah possibly as well. And then we will talk with Rabbi Yisachar Dov Krakowski, who is the director of the OU Kosher in Israel, and he's also a noted posek and author.
Now for a word from our sponsor. Headlines started something new this week until Pesach. DafHeadlines.com. And what is it? It's also on All Daf. It's 5 minutes every morning, some interesting halacha from the Daf. Something debatable, maybe a little controversial, maybe something to discuss with your friend. And part of it after that, it's 5 minutes, it's divided to that, and something like a vart of chizuk. I don't know about you, but I could always use a little chizuk. Life is a handful. Energize your day with something divrei elokim chayim, some plasma to get your day going. If you go to dafheadlines.com, you could sign up. You could either get it by WhatsApp, by text, by email, whole assortment of ways, or you could always get it on the OU site on All Daf.
Joining us now is Rabbi Yitzchak Breidowitz. Rabbi Breidowitz is the Rav of the Kehillat Or Sameach. He is a renowned posek in Baruch Hashem. He is a regular here on Headlines. Rabbi Breidowitz, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Rabbi Ari. It is always a pleasure and an honor.
So we're talking about meat, M-E-A-T, and I just want to start with a fundamental question I've had for quite a long time. Vegetarianism, veganism, as a philosophy, let's leave aside if somebody does it for health reasons, but as a philosophy, is that hashkafically problematic for somebody to say, I'm going to be a vegan or a vegetarian because I feel bad for those animals, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu indeed said, go ahead, eat the animals. If God didn't have a problem with it, is there a problem if somebody does have a problem with it?
I think that's a very, very excellent question. Obviously, as you pointed out in the question, if one is a vegetarian or even a vegan for health reasons, that's absolutely legitimate, and indeed that would be a mitzvah to preserve your health. But if one takes the position that it is immoral to kill animals for human consumption, I do think that that very much approaches a certain type of heresy. Because if God said that something is permitted, and if God said that this is legitimate, any philosophy that simply says this is something that is morally wrong would be accusing God of something that is immoral. So as a result, any philosophy or belief that it is morally repugnant to take the life of an animal for human consumption, I think is religiously problematic. However, I would make a distinction. If I am against the killing of an animal for human consumption, I think that is a problem. If, on the other hand, I don't eat meat because I want to protest against factory farming, I want to protest against the conditions under which animals are caged, or the like, I think that is legitimate because, after all, tzar balei chayim, causing unnecessary pain to animals, is something that is against the Torah. And although numerous research has demonstrated over 150 years that the actual process of shechita is painless, and there's no problem with that, but a lot of the stuff that we do before shechita, which is really a product of modern factory farming and meat production, may raise some ethical problems. Now, I don't endorse the conservative reform idea of eco-kashrut. I don't think we can use the label of non-kosher because of the inhumane treatment of animals. That was Rav Moshe's famous tshuva about veal. So I wouldn't use the nomenclature of kashrus for this type of violation, but it's certainly a morally acceptable stance to protest by not buying or eating meat. So I would differentiate between these two situations. The opposition against the killing of an animal, I think, is religiously invalid. The opposition to the mistreatment of the animal prior to its being killed, I think, has a moral cogency.
Now, when it comes to the tzar balei chayim and the treatment of the animals pre-shechita, what standards do we use? Do we defer to the halachic standards of tzar balei chayim and use those gedarim, or do we defer to the more secular societal standards, which are probably much more extreme than would be required by halacha? The animal rights, you know, and animal rights, it's much more extreme than the Tzar Balei Chaim guidelines.
Well, it would seem to me that anyone that is formulating a Jewish response as to what is inhumane conduct vis-a-vis animals would primarily focus on what the Jewish standards are. Now, I do want to say, though, it's a little tricky because there are basic minimal standards, and then there's going lifnim mishurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law to embrace the spirit of the law, so that would allow a certain amount of expansion. But I don't think it would go to the level of animal rights. The animal rights movement is basically against killing animals for any purpose at all. And I think, as I said before, I think Jewish religious philosophy would reject that as an unduly extreme position.
Now, this has been a discussion on the hashkafic level of vegetarianism, veganism. If we can enter the realm of halacha, somebody who is a vegetarian, a vegan, for maybe health reasons or for other reasons, or they don't like the treatment of animals, are there possibly halachic problems? For example, come to Shabbos, come to Yom Tov, is there a chiyuv to eat meat, or is that not an obligation?
Yeah, so this is interesting. You are correct that obviously if I don't eat meat during the week, putting aside the philosophy, there's no halachic issue, and in fact it may generally be healthier not to. And there's even a statement in the Gemara, an Am Haaretz, one who is not really connected to Torah at a high level, perhaps shouldn't eat meat at all. Although that it says usher to eat meat, that doesn't mean usher, but meat does not belong to him, so to speak. But the issue becomes on Shabbos. There's a mitzvah of Oneg Shabbos, enjoying the Shabbos. On Yom Tov, there's the mitzvah is formulated with a different term, the mitzvah of Simcha on Yom Tov. And the question becomes, does that require eating meat? So initially, let me say that Oneg is a little different than Simcha. Oneg Shabbos is given, I think, a much more subjective definition. So, for example, the Shulchan Aruch says, if it is more pleasurable to me to even fast on Shabbos, I enjoy fasting, my stomach is hurting, I don't want to eat. So the halacha is the Oneg Shabbos would be to fast, although you'd have to perhaps eat a kezias to be yaitzei a seuda and the like. So clearly, if somebody doesn't like meat, if somebody doesn't want meat either because it makes them sick or they like milchiks more than fleishiks, there is no question that on Shabbos they can make the choice not to have meat. The question would be, though, let's say somebody likes meat, but they've taken a moral position, they're not eating meat. So there, it's harder to say that not eating meat is my Oneg Shabbos when the reason I'm not eating meat is for ideological concerns. But even then, it's brought down that there is no chiyuv to eat meat. If you eat meat and you like it, you are fulfilling an aspect of Oneg Shabbos. So we might call it a mitzvah, but we wouldn't call it an aveira if you don't have meat. Now, when it comes to Yom Tov, it's a little more tricky. Because Yom Tov, we have this mitzvah, v'samachta b'chagecha, to be mesameach in the chag. And although that does mean, of course, the internal emotion of joy, but Chazal understands Simchas Yom Tov to have a certain objective meaning, ein simcha ela b'basor v'yayin, that simcha is fulfilled externally by meat and wine. And by the way, that includes Chol HaMoed as well as the Chag. People realize that Basar V'Yayin is a din on Chol HaMoed as well. So the question becomes, does that mean you have to eat meat, even a little bit of meat, a spoonful of chopped liver, on a Yom Tov meal? Some opinions do say that, but the Mishnah Brewer, the Ber Halacha, actually paskin that the requirement of Basar is only Bisman HaMikdash, when the basor was the basor of the shlamim, the basor of the korbanos, eating it in the Beis HaMikdash, but when there's the Chorban Beis HaMikdash and you're not eating basor shlamim, there is no chiyuv of basor, even on Yom Tov. However, the Shulchan Aruch does say there's still a chiyuv of yayin, which is interesting. So even though we do not say ein simcha ela b'basor b'yayin, we do say ein simcha ela b'yayin. Bottom line, therefore, is contrary to what many people think, there is no absolute obligation to eat meat on Yom Tov. Although, once again, if you do enjoy it and it enhances your simcha, you would be mekayim simcha if you do it. But it's not a bittul, it's not a sin, it is not a transgression if you don't. So bottom line is that halakha will tolerate vegetarianism, both on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. So it is not an absolute chiyuv.
Now, when it comes to Yom Tov, what the Rav is saying is Eim Simcha Ela B'Yayin, and that Yayin,
yeah,
that would be an obligation to have Yayin, and that would apply in Chol HaMoed as well.
Well, that is what the Rambam's Lashon is, and I know Rebbe Yashiv was very, very makbid that every day of Yom Tov, including Chol HaMoed, one should have a little bit of wine. Now here too, there's a little bit of a shaila. What if I don't like wine? What if it's mazik me? What if it gives me a stomach ache? One could argue, although it's not so barur, that if something by definition doesn't bring you simcha, then it can't be a chiyuv of simcha to do something that is seisher the simcha. But if one can tolerate wine reasonably well, one should try. There may even be a chiyuv to have yayin, a revius of yayin, 4 fluid ounces of yayin, even on Chol HaMoed. And the interesting question is, it's not clear if you fulfill it by grape juice, because it could be the simcha of yayin is kind of the heightening of the mood, that you get a little looser because of the alcohol. So interestingly enough, even if you could be yotzei kiddush with grape juice, the svara is you will not be yotzei simcha with grape juice.
So Rabbi Breidowitz, let me ask you, Rav Kook himself was allegedly a vegetarian, and he had certain unique views on vegetarianism. So if you could walk us through exactly what his approach was, that would be really helpful.
Yes, I'm very glad that you brought it up. In point of fact, Rav Kook was not an actual vegetarian. Rav Kook did have meat on Shabbos and Yom Tov. He ate very little meat. He ate very little generally. And during the week, he did not have meat. But once again, very few people had meat during the week in Yerushalayim. But Rav Kook does have some very interesting views on vegetarianism. He points to the fact that in the ideal world that Hashem created, Adam HaRishon and Chava were supposed to be vegetarians, and that remained in effect until the Mabul, and only after the flood were Noach and his progeny and the human race permitted to eat meat. So Rav Kook posits that in a sense vegetarianism is the ideal, because it represents compassion for animals, it represents not using other types of animal life for one's own selfish purposes. And Rav Kook even suggests that Limota Mashiach, we will no longer have animal offerings. They will be replaced by vegetable and grain offerings. Now, it's understood that Rav Kook cannot mean that 100% literally. Number one, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Malachim that Mashiach will not be mevatel any of the mitzvahs of the Torah, including korbanos, the Rambam says. And the Navi Yecheskel himself, when he describes the third Beis HaMikdash, has a whole regimen of animal offerings. But people explain that Rav Kook does not mean as soon as Mashiach comes, animal offerings will be batel, but it means even within the Messianic era, there are going to be gradual transformations and spiritual elevations, and at some indeterminate point, maybe hundreds, thousands of years into Mashiach, there will be a transition to something higher. Be it as it may, however you understand Rav Kook and Korbanos, Rav Kook certainly does advocate vegetarianism as an ideal lifestyle that represents reverence for all life, but he has an extremely important qualification that we need to keep in mind. He basically says vegetarianism is the next level up after we've achieved a perfection in our human interactions. As I perfect myself in my Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, I become compassionate, kind, generous, forgiving, so then I move to the next level. Rav Kook says there's a tremendous danger in spiritual growth that when you try to jump to a higher level before you have mastered the lower level, that higher level might actually be destructive and counterproductive. So Rav Kook actually says that until society reaches the level of perfection in its human-to-human interaction, we don't necessarily move to the next step, other than, of course, the parameters of Tsar Bali Chaim. Now, I know that you cannot prove anything by anecdote, but indeed, we know that Hitler himself was a vegetarian, and we know that his vegetarian impulses did not translate into a care and compassion for human beings. And once again, it's been well said that when you try to be overly conscientious in terms of how we deal with animals, instead of raising your compassion for animals, you may be degrading your compassion for human beings. By equating humans and animals, you're not necessarily lifting the animal. You might be lowering the human being. We've seen this with Peter Singer, who basically said that saving a dog might be more important than saving a retarded or an impaired or a handicapped child. So one has to be very, very careful. Let me just mention finally, although Rav Kook does not talk about this much, that in Kabbalistic parlance, there is an idea that eating the animal is actually a chesed for the animal itself, because by incorporating it within the higher neshama of the human being, you are now enabling the animal soul to reach a higher level when it is now part of an organism that is learning Torah and doing mitzvahs. So it is a complicated issue. I do want to emphasize Rav Kook was not a vegetarian, but he did suggest that at some indeterminate point in the future, vegetarianism might be the preferred higher moral position.
But certainly not nowadays.
I believe right now he was not advocating it, and he indeed pointed out the dangers that I think have been borne out in Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo, and Lahavdil, Peter Singer.
Thank you for that clarification, Rabbi Breidowitz. So where we are right now is being a vegetarian, a vegan, on philosophical grounds because it's inhumane is problematic.
Yeah.
But even if somebody is a vegetarian, a vegan for philosophical issues, reasons, we got into the question of, but is there an obligation to eat meat on Shabbos and Yom Tov? But there are hetterim on both, certainly on Shabbos and also on
Yep.
Yom Tov.
Yep.
How
Yep,
about
there are.
Bris? I mean, I've been at Bris's and it's at 8:30 in the morning and they have meat on the table. So is there an absolute chiyuv to have meat at the Bris? And if so, how will a vegetarian deal with that? Do you not have a kiyum of the suud at a Bris? And if you're giving the Bris, then you're not participating in the Bris if you don't have the meat. How does that play out?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Obviously, the suda of a bris milah is a sudas mitzvah, and the halacha is that a sudas mitzvah should have the chashivas of basar. So if you just read the halacha very literally, that would mean that a suda of a bris milah does have to have fleishiks. However, as you know, as all of us know, it's very common. Some people do have fleishiks even if it's 8 o'clock in the morning. But usually, if a bris is in the morning hours, they do serve milchiks. And the modern Paiskim have various reasons why such a minhag developed, even though it's apparently in contravention of halacha. Some say it dated from the time in Germany, 19th century Germany, where there was the growth of the Reform movement, and you couldn't trust a lot of people's kashrus, so they became a minhag to serve milchiks. Others say this was actually a takana. Because of poverty, because communities, many people could not afford fleishiks, and in order not to embarrass people who couldn't afford it, they made it a simpler type of bris. Rav Moshe Stirnbach actually has a tshuva, but he was chayzer from it. But in his initial tshuva, he actually said, since meat, really kind of a very very logical idea, since meat is hard for people to eat in the morning. So when a suda is made in the morning hours, there never was a chiyuv to have meat because that's not the type of thing that sits well with people in the morning, and therefore, depending on the hour, a non-fleishik bris would be permissible. He later was chayzer. In a later tshuva, he said you should try to have fleishiks for everything. But let me point out, too, that even in the general rule that a sudas mitzvah should have basar, there are shittos that say dogim is bichlal basor, a fish. So if there's a tuna fish or a lox or herring or whatever it would be, there are some poskim that do say that that will have the status of basor. In fact, even for Yom Tov, there are some that say that. And if they don't say it by Yom Tov, that's because it's not doymet to basor shlamim, ma she'en kein legabe the normal obligations of sudas mitzvah, fish might be sufficient. So there are a number of tzedakim. There's the hour of the day, there's the poverty, there's the kashrus issues, which again wouldn't necessarily apply in every case, and there's the fact that fish might be a substitute. But there's another point I want to raise, which came out in your question, and that is when we say that a sudas mitzvah has to be basur, is that referring to what you as a guest have to eat to be mekayim? See, it's not so mukhrach. It could be that as long as the avi haben is making a sudas basor, perhaps your participation in that suda may be a valid participation even if you don't eat meat. So I think there may be a svara that if I am a vegetarian who is invited to a fleishik bris, I am still considered a mishtatef in a sudas mitzvah, even if I'm not actually eating the meat. I think I need to think about that a little bit and do some more research. But just thinking out loud, I think your conclusion that if you need meat, the guy that doesn't eat meat is not mekayem the inyan of a sudas mitzvah by a bris. Perhaps that doesn't necessarily follow.
Now, Rabbi Reiter, as we're talking about meat in general, can we define that? Are we talking about red meat or chicken, for example, if we go back to the example of Simcha and Yontif or at a bris? Does chicken fit the bill, or are we talking specifically red meat?
So here, again, as I say, we have a number of machlokim, and I think we need to be machalek between Shabbos, bris, and Yomtif. There may be different definitions that apply. When you're dealing with Shabbos or Sudas Mitzvah, like a bris milah, then it seems fairly logical that chicken would indeed qualify because it has the chashivas of meat. People treat it like meat, at least midrabanan, you have to wait, you know, 6 hours after chicken. So in Svara, one would be mekayim, the inyan of achilas basar with meat, with chicken, and as I say, some poskim say, even with fish, kal v'chomer with chicken. When it comes to yomtif, it's a bit more of a problem. Because if the basis of the chiyuv of eating meat, well, actually, I said the Be'er Halacha says there is no chiyuv, but there is at least a mitzvah. Some shitas say there is a chiyuv, midrabanan, but the chiyuv is based on the simcha of achilas basar shlamim. Now, that is a unique construct that is a yomtif idea. That's not the basis for a bris, and that's not the basis for Shabbos. So here the problem is, if the achila has to be similar to shlamim, then you have a problem that a korban shlamim in the Beis HaMikdash was red meat, was bakar, was from a cow, and there were no korbanos of chickens and the like. So there may be a havamina or a svara that for sudas yomtif you're not mekayim the mitzvah of simcha bebasar unless it is red meat. Even though for the oneg of Shabbos or the chashivas of Sudas Mitzvah, chicken and some say even fish would be okay. But lemaisa, many say that the dimyan to shlamim does not have to be complete, and as a result, they would allow chicken to be a kiyum for a suda, even for a mitzvah of yomtif. But again, it's something, there is a svara to be more machmer and yomtif than Shabbos with that respect. By the way, one of the reasons why chicken became the preferred like Shabbos food is that until World War II, I believe that chicken was sometimes more expensive than meat. So meat was a chol food, a food that you ate during the week. Chicken was very, very special. After World War II, the whole economy changed, and chicken became a cheaper meat, but the minhag already came that you saved it for Shabbos.
Interesting. Time to get that red meat more focused on.
Right.
So far we've heard heterim for Shabbos and somewhat for Yontif and less so, but somewhat for a bris. How about comes this Pesach? Here at Hashem, we're going to have a Beis HaMikdash. We're going to have a Korban Pesach. Is there any chiyuv?
Yeah.
If somebody's a vegetarian, a vegan, for whatever reason, we're talking about a kares issue, is there any heter to get out of eating the Korban Pesach?
So again, the Korban Pesach is the one thing for which there are no substitutions. You can't have fish or chicken instead of the Korban Pesach. It has to come from a sheep or a goat. And I'm sorry, a sheep. And the halacha is that every chayav to eat, unless they're pater from the Korban Pesach, they're chayef to eat a little bit of the Korban Pesach. Now, that's not a lot. You only have to eat a kezayis of the Korban Pesach, the size of a large olive. That's not too much meat. But I think one has to do the mitzvah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and unless it's a pikuach nefesh type of situation, there is no heter to invoke any type of philosophy or even health consideration short of pikuach nefesh to get out of eating the Korban Pesach. But again, one little modification to your question. The chiyuv kares is only if a person does not bring the Korban Pesach. If a person brought the Korban Pesach, or a person was part of a chabura, a group that brought the Korban Pesach, and the only thing he failed to do was he failed to eat the Korban Pesach, he is transgressing a positive commandment, but he is not chayiv karis for the failure to eat.
Right, right. Okay, just to end off, you mentioned veal before. So somebody comes to you and says, I love veal. What would be your psak on veal? I don't know if they have it in Eretz Yisrael. I haven't seen it in the past 10 years or so since being here. But if we could get veal, would you eat it with me?
Well, you know, it's not shayach for me to say that it is forbidden to eat veal if it's under a reliable hashgacha. Veal is permitted to eat. And the fact that it may have been produced by inhumane conditions does not make the meat treif. That was Rav Moshe's tshuva. And in the famous Vidoy, there's a famous confession from Rabbeinu Nisim Gaon, going all the way back to the Gaonim, that we have to ask Hashem's mechila for permitting that which was usher and for ushering that which is permitted. So to say that something's usher when it's not is also an aveira. That's Megalut Panim B'Teresh Loka Halacha. You're exposing aspects of the Torah in a false light. So there's no way that I can say that it's usher. Nevertheless, I personally would try not to eat veal because I don't want to be machazek the inhumane treatment of animals. It's it's very much of a shame the way animals are mistreated. And I think particularly in the case of veal, where these young calves are penned up in order to get fat, so they keep their flesh white, that there's no exercise, so to speak. And, you know, just because of the taiva that people may have for a certain taste, that really does not justify the pain and the tsar that animals are going through. Do you remember the Gemara in Rav Metzia, that Rav Yehuda HaNasi, the great Rebbe, was walking, and a calf was being led to slaughter, and the calf ran to him for protection, and he pushed away the calf, and he said, L'chach netzarta, this is your fate, this is why you were created. It was said that Hashem was geyser on Rebbe, awful, awful yisurin, because he did not have rachamim for that calf, and the yisurin didn't go away until years later. There were field mice in the house, and the maid was going to sweep them away, and Rebbe said, let them stay, for Rachamav al kol masaf, Hashem's mercy is on all of his creations, and immediately the pains went away because he showed Rachamim. So Rachamim is a very, very precious quality, and it's important that we try to foster it. So I absolutely will not say veal is usher. That would be a perversion of halacha. One cannot say that. But I do think there may be some significance in not eating it.
Rabbi Breidowitz, I want to thank you for joining us. It is always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Be well. Much hatzlacha. Kol tov.
Joining us now is Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt. Rabbi Goldschmidt has been the chief rabbi of Moscow for close to 30 years, and he is the president of the Conference of European Rabbis that unites 700 communal rabbis throughout Europe. Rabbi Goldschmidt, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be on your program.
So, Rabbi Goldschmidt, I was reading recently that you're dealing with some serious shechita issues in Belgium and possibly elsewhere in Europe. And I wanted to find out what's going on in Europe, and are people just not getting meat?
European parliaments and European courts have decided again that animals are more important than Jews. And in the last few years, there have been numerous attempts to curtail and ban Shechita and Bris Mila and closing Jewish schools in different European countries and cities. And in Belgium, in two regions, in Wallonia and Flanders, they banned Shechita outright. We have to say that really we are not the prime targets. It is the Muslims. There are 40 million Muslims living in the European Union among more than 450 million people. So we're talking of quite a big percentage. And it is this anti-immigration bill making life difficult for Muslims. And we, as Jews, are the collateral damage. We can import meat from other countries into Belgium, like in Switzerland. Switzerland was the first country where Shechita was forbidden since 1895. another country which forbade shechita was Nazi Germany. Right after 1933, the reason was that they wanted to get rid of the Jews, so they made life difficult for them before they came up with the final solution. In Switzerland, the reason they took on this law was to stop Russian Jews who were religious to come to live in Switzerland. So you can import kosher meat into this country, but it's not fresh, and secondly, it's much more expensive.
And I assume it kind of creates an environment of the Jews feeling hated, not wanted.
I once pictured the situation of Jews in Europe the following way. It's like a person standing on a train track, and from both sides, the trains arriving with ever greater faster. From one side is a train of the Muslim Islamic terrorism, and from another side are these laws against us, Shechita Milan. So we're having a problem.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned that Bris Mila as well. Has Bris Mila been banned in certain countries?
One country, Slovenia, has banned Bris Mila. Fortunately, there's a quite insignificant Jewish community. They're very small. But there have been attempts in Finland and in Iceland and in Germany to ban Bris Mila. We have to fight for it.
And this is targeted at the Muslims? Is this also part of human rights issues? What's the basis for the bans?
It's animal rights. It is children's rights. That's the mask. That's the official say, oh, we're not against the Jews. Before, we want Europe without the Jews. It's not Europe. However, children's rights, and who gave you the right to make a non-medical operation on your child because you're religious. So let the child grow up, be at the age of 15, 16, and then let the child decide if the child wants a bris mila, a circumcision, or whatever. That's what those organizations which come out against bris mila are saying. What we are saying is that the same way that parents are allowed to take the children skiing, and they're endangering the children, the same way parents are allowed to take their children to an orthodontist, to straighten their teeth. Who says that you're allowed to let the child suffer because you want the child to have straight teeth? Maybe having crooked teeth looks even better. So it is a social decision that the teeth which are straight look better, and therefore you're allowed to have your child going through long procedures which are not easy in order to have your child having different kinds of teeth. So in what way is Bris Mila different? The only country where parents were not allowed to educate their child in a religious manner was the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, if a person made a Bris Mila for his child, he was sent for 5 years to Siberia. In Iceland, they decided to pass a law where if a person makes a Bris Mila for his child, he's going to be sent 6 years to prison. So we are
that was right current,
now,
recently?
Recently?
That was recently?
Yes. And we stopped it with a lot of lobbying, and I would like here to mention many of the major American Jewish organizations which took part in this lobbying effort, and we had a letter from the leaders of the Committee for Foreign Relations of the House and the Senate sending letters to the Icelandic government to stop this nonsense. So this is what's happening here, and we're witnessing this tsunami of anti-religious laws coming from one country to another country in Europe. Now, this after the two regions in Belgium banned Shechita, the Belgian Jewish community together with the Muslim community went to the Supreme Court of Belgium, and they referred it to the Supreme Court of Europe, which is called the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And the court in Luxembourg came out with a decision that such a decision is according to the law and is not curtailing religious freedom, which a decision which does not make any sense, because they said that if you stun an animal and the stun is reversible, so halacha allows it, which is total nonsense. I don't know who those judges who are total amaratzim in religious law, who they consulted with, the Jewish community, and I would say there is a consensus among all the rabbanim, Orthodox rabbanim, that stunning is not permissible for many different reasons. Whoever wants to study this aspect should look at the Sheilas and Tefillos of the Svidaish, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the head of the Ravina Seminar, of the Seminary for Rabbis in Berlin, which is the main Moshe Latoya before World War II. And he went, and after the Gezeira against Hitler in Nazi Germany, went to Poland to discuss this issue with the big Paskim and halachic authorities in Poland, with Chaim Isaac Grudzinski and others, and they all told him, under no circumstances can we agree to stunning before Shechitah. And this has been the practice since then, you know, among all the Kehillahs and all of Tzadisra. I would say that with hindsight, the fact that the Gdeli Israel did not permit stunning before Shechitah to Jews in Germany actually saved the lives of many Jews. Why? Because there were 500,000 Jews in Germany back then, and many of them decided once Shechitah was outlawed to leave Germany. And they left in 1934, 35, 36, when some countries were still open and some countries still accepted Jews. All those Jews who stayed till 1938 in Germany, unfortunately, most of them were killed in concentration camps. So actually, the decision of the Gdol Yisrael not to give in on the Shechitah issue, and standing before Shechitah, some people like today would say, oh, the rabbis don't understand, the rabbanim are too hard-lined, the rabbanim don't see the Messias. But actually, this decision saved, I think, the lives of tens of thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of Jews.
Wow. And that shows that banning Shechitah creates an environment of hostility, animosity, if people are leaving because of that.
I was born in Switzerland. I just visited Switzerland not long ago. And I went to the kosher butcher shop in Zurich. Do you know how much you pay for a pound of goods, you know, with a steak meat in Zurich, in Switzerland?
No.
$60.
So, Rabbi Goldschmidt, do you have a concern that the animal rights or the anti-Muslim movement could move over to the United States and start movements in banning Brisim and Shechitah as well there?
Unfortunately, I have to say the following, is that for many, many years, Jews in the United States, whether from or not from, liberal Jews or conservative Jews, they thought that the United States is exceptional. This can never happen in the United States. Anti-Semitism. Unfortunately, in the last 2 years, we have seen that more Jews were killed in the United States for being Jewish than in Europe. We have seen scenes in Washington which till now we thought were only to be seen in the Balkans or some banana republics. So the wishful view that the United States is radically different than the whole world and processes which happen in the whole world cannot happen in the United States. I think that the reality shows otherwise, unfortunately.
Right, right. So, Rabbi Goldschmidt, what we're talking about is animal rights and liberal views and the impact on Shechitah and Brisim in general. Would you say that if a frum Jew decides they want to be a vegetarian or a vegan for hashkafa reasons, would you, as a posek, say that is not a halachically appropriate approach to making that decision?
There are views within within I would call it traditional Judaism, which propagate vegetarianism and veganism. I would like to just quote, for example, the Baal Shem of Michelstadt was known to be a vegetarian. I know that many Mekubalim are vegetarian. For example, Rav David Cohen, who was known as a Nazir in Yerushalayim, was not only vegetarian, he didn't wear any cloth which came from animals. So there are certain views which see in not using anything coming from an animal as a certain madrega, and which is also among Mekubalim, etc. There is such a view in Yiddishkeit. And besides that, there are also there are medical views which support the view that not eating meat and chicken, especially because they're being treated with hormones and antibiotics, from a medical point of view, is a good decision. There's a China study, for example. However, I think that this is a personal decision of every person. If a person wants to go and become a vegetarian or become vegan, I have one daughter who's a vegan. Okay, it's a choice. But to force a whole community to change their ways, who gave them the right to force the community to do that? And if we're talking about those people who fight for animal rights in Europe, how come they only fight about shechita? First of all, who told them that shechita is less humane than any other way of killing by gas or by electroshock? Who says that the animal suffers less or more? How about hunting? Hunting is legal in all those countries. In many countries, there also, in Belgium, for example, there's a whole festival where they eat live fish. They're putting also crabs, live crabs, into boiling water. What, this is humane? This is less problematic than shechita? And having in Spain, those in the arenas, we have those big bullfights. That's not Tzar Baal Chaim. This is legal.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That's what we're dealing with nowadays. Well, Rabbi Goldschmidt, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It definitely has been very educational. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Rabbi Wasserman, thank you very much for having me, and wish all the listeners they should all be healthy, number one. So all be careful, number two, and we should only have this full study.
Joining us now is Rabbi Yisachar Dov Krakowski. Rabbi Krakowski is the director of Kashrus for the Orthodox Union in Israel. He is the Rosh Kollel of Rav Tzvi Koshelevsky's Yeshiva Heichal HaTorah. He's a popular lecturer and a noted author. Rabbi Krakowski, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And Rabbi Wasserman, it's great to have you in the neighborhood and to be able to be a neighbor of yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Rabbi Krakowski. So, Rabbi Krakowski, we're talking about meat, various issues as it relates to meat and shechita, which is actually your expertise, one of your expertises. But before that, my wife just told me right before the call that you were one of the first kashrus experts getting to Dubai recently in order to kasher when the whole delegation of Israelis were going to do the deal or right after the deal with the UAE. So I would love to hear about some of the issues that came up there and just what your general impression was of the UAE.
Okay, so I'll actually say we were in Dubai already before any of the peace talks. I've actually personally been in Saudi Arabia even, and in various other countries in the region. Part of that has to do with the idea of trying to expand the OU kashrus, as we're always trying to do, to make more and more products in more and more places. Kosher, so the tzibur can have, you know, products that are kosher l'chatchilo worldwide. I've been there already for, I've been going there for a while now. It's not, something very recent. What's changed, I guess, with the peace accords is that there's a lot more awareness, A, amongst the, populace in the area about kosher. And second of all, one of the things, I guess, the Yishmaelim, the Arabs got from maybe being Enikloch or having some sort of, relationship with Yishmael, that they've gotten some of the Abrahamic Achnasas Archim. And therefore, as part of this peace initiative, they're very, very into trying to make Jews feel at home. And therefore, they're unfortunately under the wrong impression. I mean, unfortunately, it's unfortunate that it's not correct, that all Jews keep kosher and all Israelis keep kosher. And if you want them to be able to come to your country, you have to be able to provide them with kosher food. So the need and the awareness of kosher has grown immensely there since the peace accords. Some of the things that we originally did were some of the, when they had the Israeli-American delegation going to Abu Dhabi in order to prepare the actual, peace accords to be signed with all the intricacies of the various departments and the cooperation between different government agencies, et cetera. So they hosted, in Abu Dhabi, they hosted an Israeli-American delegation. And they wanted that to be kosher. In order to make that kosher, they brought in the OU. I oversaw that personally. I had mashgichim that were there already from, it was on Sunday, so I had mashgichim there from before Shabbos to ascertain that the kitchen was cleaned and closed so that it wouldn't be a ben yomo, wouldn't be used for 24 hours, so it would be able to start the koshering Sunday morning, so it would be able to get food out already Sunday evening. In fact, they actually started in Motzei Shabbos with the koshering. But that way, by Sunday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon or so, a little bit earlier, 2 o'clock, maybe something like that, it was already kosher, the kitchen. So that was one of the earlier big hospitality types of things we did there. And since then, we now are certifying, one kosher kitchen in Dubai. We have another few that are, in the midst of being built. Brand new kitchens. They're not trying to save any money and, trying to find shortcuts in terms of using used equipment that haven't been koshered. So we have another two businesses on the way in Dubai, another business in Abu Dhabi, very near to being finished. But there's a lot of other stuff going on there. I can't say, I don't know how everybody else is doing their kashrus work. Everything we're doing there, everything we plan to do there will be with Hashgacha Tamidus.
Fascinating. All right. Thank you for those insights. So why don't we dive into the topic of the day? We're talking about meat, and something that I read about recently is the synthetic meat, and I'd love to hear about the discussion of what that is, and does that mean we'll be able to have parv meat, flesh meat? I assume it's a shahakol, so if you can walk us through that sugya, that would be super.
Okay. So I'll reshine, just to, give a very brief explanation of what synthetic meat is. We all know about cloning, it's something that's been talked about for the past, 25, 30 years. They've been talking about cloning, and we know that, it might be possible to clone animals or human beings and create, a yeshmi ayin, so to speak, almost. But basically, the idea over here is to clone the piece of meat, which means taking a meat cell and reproducing that meat cell. Eventually, as they've been progressing with the experiments in this, so not only can they reproduce the cells, it's to try to reproduce the growth of the cells that it comes out to resemble, different cuts of meat or things like that. Right now, what they've been successful in doing is to create different growths of different types of cells so that they can make something like a hamburger or, a sausage, a hot dog, or, whatever you want, a Frankfurt or whatever you want to call it. Things that aren't like a piece of meat, but that are actually just, really ground beef mixed with, some other ingredients. So here they can reproduce the different cells and mix them together, but they haven't really created, pieces of steak or meat, but they're close to that. They say by the year of 2025, it should be available for the larger customer market, in supermarkets, et cetera. It has a lot of impacts in terms of environmentalists are very interested in things like this because when they talk about the carbon footprint of cows they're even talking about now the putting masks on cows to diminish their their carbon footprint, et cetera. So this would significantly diminish it if you can create meat in the laboratory without actually having to raise cattle to be able to have meat. So that's the probably one of the biggest milas to the general world. Another mila is for people who are vegetarian. So this meat doesn't really pose any tzar bali chayim type of issues or animal rights activist type of issues, except for that originally it did come from an animal at some point in time. In terms of kashrus, there's been a lot of fancy articles that have been written on the topic, some of which are wonderful, some of which might be a little bit ridiculous, but I don't know that we even need to get to any of those articles. In terms of kosher, that's the one thing that I will discuss, that yes, I think it needs to be derived. We have the basic klal of kol yotze min ha-tamei tamei, kol yotze min ha-tar, so it needs to come out of something which is kosher. Then people want to claim that it's microscopic, so it's as if it's not there, but it's something which we extracted. It's something microscopic that we extracted, so we know that it's there. It's not like, a microscopic bug or, a dust mite that everybody's inhaling constantly, microscopic living organisms into their body, and nobody's concerned with that from a halachic vantage point. So it's not like those types of ideas, without getting into more complicated sugyas where Chazal talked about minoy gavle, things that some people would classify as spontaneous generation, which that's obviously also something that Chazal didn't make up, spontaneous generation. We're talking about something starting from something which is microscopic, etc. Those are sugyas b'smei atzmam that can be talked about. I'm sure they've been talked about probably in previous headlines. And if not, I'm sure you'll talk about them in the future. Over here, even though it's microscopic, we extracted it purposely. We know that it's there because we extracted it. We're growing it into something. Therefore, l'chayr, again, without getting into all the tedious lomdus on the sugya, l'chayr, it would need to be yaitim and atar. And, being that we're makbid on glot, and being that it's only a one-time thing, by and large, so it would be definitely recommended to use, a glot piece of meat, and then it could be, super kosher, glot, base yaitis, everything. And you take that type of meat, piece of meat, and you can reestablish from its, something that you take out of it, that you extrapolate, that one little cell, and create a future meat. In terms of whether it's fleishiks or not, I think that it's a dover pashut, that it's fleishiks. I'll explain to you why. I don't think it has to do with lomdus. I think it has to do with our approach to fleishik. Midairaisa, you can take a chicken and cook it with milk, cook it in milk. You can make your own, think about that. You can have a cream chicken soup, midairaisa. However, Chazal, we're geizer that we don't mix a chicken and milk because we call chicken basar. Basar ayis is called basar. Ayis said it's called basar. We don't want it to get confused, and we don't want people to, misconstrue the halachos and extrapolate from one scenario to another, etc. And we make it very clear, anything which you call basar generally is referred to as meat or meat-like products are going to be considered fleishik. That being said, over here, this is something which is identical to meat. That's what we're trying to get to. Something which cannot be identified as being different, possibly even in a laboratory. You break it down, it has the exact breakdown of a piece of bona fide meat that you just shechted and cut off, kasher, and cut off the cow and cooked. It's going to be identical. If it's identical, I don't understand how anybody in their right mind would say that, no, we're not going to view it as fleishiks, even if somehow technically in the world of lomdus, they come up with a lomdus to say that it's not fleishiks. So I think that really, once push comes to shove, it's going to be fleishiks. And I think above and beyond that, we're also going to attach to synthetic meat all the halachos that we attach to real meat, which means in our chaysam te chaysam, that when it's sealed, it has to be double, it has to have a double seal on it. It's going to be the halachos of basar shenis alam in the ayin, that it can't be, unwatched, so to speak, that it needs to be constant supervision over it. All those halachos will pertain to this piece of meat, as such. You know, maybe not malicha, maybe not other halachos, but all those halachos, you don't have when to do malicha, it was never chai, it was never shechted, the halachos of shechita won't apply to it, it will have applied to where you take it out from originally, but how we treat the piece of meat as a piece of meat, l'dati, will be exactly identical to the way we treat any other piece of meat.
So when it comes to synthetic meat, what we're saying is if it looks like it, if it smells like it, it is it, and accordingly we'll treat it as flesh. So when it comes along a similar line, when it comes to if we have parve cheese and eating that with a hamburger, or if we have regular cheese and eating that with a veggie burger, how should those be treated? Do we have a Marasayan issue? Do we have something more than that?
Okay, so I mean, I think that's very, very different. I understand the comparison and the question, but I think it's very different than the piece of lab-produced meat. Well, both of them are, you know, so to speak, not meat that was, you know, you just took a cow, shechted it, and took the meat off, etc. One is really meat by almost every definition, and one is really something totally else. So the shaylov is really what you said at the end of it. Is there an Maris Ayin issue? That's, you know, some veggie burgers might look, you know, really much like meat, and some cheese. You know, I don't know about the Ashkacha on it, but there was once a restaurant that was discussing about making cheeseburgers with us, and he said he found a cheese that even melted. Very often the synthetic, the parve cheeses don't melt the same way that, you know, regular cheese does. So he said he wanted that, like, you know, the cheese dripping down the side of a hamburger type of look. Apparently that's the way cheeseburgers look. And that he wanted that type of look, and he found a parve cheese that has, you know, that actually melts a little bit even. So this isn't a new shaila. It's a shaila that's discussed by the Rama already in the Yeridea by cooking meat in Cholav Shkedim. So it's actually, the Rama is a little bit of a chiddush. Not everybody agrees to the Rama. It could be that the shaila of Maris Ayin is only pertinent to a shaila of an outright deraisa, and that it's only that it's also only limited to scenarios that Chazal discussed the issue of Maris Ayin. And over here, the Rama seems to make up, so to speak, his own new Maris Ayin. It's not discussed in the sugyas of Maris Ayin in Shas. It's the Rama's own din of Maris Ayin. So the OU's approach, as Ben Rebelski wrote a tshuva on this, Ben Rebelski Zecher Bracha wrote a tshuva on this, saying that it's kind of the Rama's own chiddush of Maris Ayin, that he's saying that is how we're noyig, like the Rama, but that it's the same way that you're able to be mechadish, a new din of Maris Ayin, you're able to take off one of these new Maris Ayins once it loses that status of being Maris Ayin. Meaning, I'll throw out a different question. Wearing synthetic leather shoes on Tisha B'Av. Now, without getting into the shaila about wearing shoes on Tisha B'Av, even if they're not leather, like that's really a machlokes rishonim, but since most people are not to wear shoes that aren't leather on Tisha B'Av, so would you be able to wear synthetic leather sneakers? And a lot of sneakers aren't made with any real leather nowadays. A lot of dress shoes might not even be made with synthetic leather. You can certainly go to, you know, various low-cost shoe stores and get synthetic leather dress shoes. So would, you know, one be able to wear that on Tisha B'Av, or would it be a problem of Maris Ayin? Or better yet, Yom Kippur, where it's even a deraisa. So once something becomes a norm, that people know there is much of this product out there that isn't what it appears to be. So there isn't any more problem with Maris Ayin, because people assume, you don't necessarily assume anymore that something which looks milchix is milchix.
It's common knowledge.
Right.
Once it's common knowledge that it's not a problem, that people are doing it in a heter way, then it's not a problem anymore. It's not a Maris Ayin at that point.
Once it becomes done, and you wouldn't necessarily assume somebody's doing anything that's wrong at that point. So what the OU's policy actually is, to avoid any Maris Ayin and, you know, to try to make sure as best as possible that there isn't any Indian of Maris Ayin, is that in restaurants we do require them to write it in the menu and even to write it on the receipt, either parva cheeseburger or what do you call it, or you know, something like that. And it's part of a cheeseburger it's part of a cheeseburger in some way or another. If it's a Mexican restaurant, you'll understand the burger's part of it. If it's a Flacian restaurant, you'll understand that the cheese is part of it. And if it's a vegan restaurant, you know, you can just write vegan cheeseburger or something like that, and that would suffice. And you know, Schachter actually, so Herschel Schachter feels that the idea of writing it is actually just even to spread a little bit more that idea that there is such a thing which is shaykh.
Right. This is unrelated to that. This is a shchita shaila that I've had for a long time. I used to go for many years to store hawkers in Sanhedria. There's one closer, so we go there. Actually, they deliver, especially during Corona. That's very helpful when stores deliver. But I remember one time going into hawkers, and their default hashkacha was sheirit. And I remember somebody coming in saying, I don't want the sheirit. I like the Eid HaRedis chicken. And I was wondering, there are some fabulous hashkachas here in Eretz Yisrael. There's the Eida, there's Landau, there's Reuben, there's Sheirit, etc. Are there fundamental differences when we're talking about meat specifically, the shechita, that one would say yours is treif, or the differences in hidurim? How can we classify it? Is one better than the other?
So, you know, firstly, we have to bear in mind that if something comes with a valid minhag, so then we generally wouldn't say that it's treif. Again, in Yerodea, we paskin that in certain cities where they were nayig to eat meat that in other cities they weren't, shas of sechus and reason, similar to maybe the differences between glat according to the Raman according to the Mechaber, but even bigger differences that and the shas of chelas, where certain cities ate certain fats that other cities assumed to be chelas, that we didn't assume that it tarfen the kalim. Okay, so to say trace, that's a very big word. Very, very big and heavy word to use when talking about any other hashgacha. That's just to start with. In terms of these fundamental differences, you know, I guess I might say as an outsider, I don't see fundamental differences, but it could be if you go to some of the various hashgachas you mentioned, they might argue that there are fundamental differences between them and another hashgacha. And one time I had a conversation with a certain American, Rav Amasher, that we sometimes do shritas together with. And we do some projects together with him in Eretz Yisrael. And he had, like, you know, this something which he was, you know, trying to push as a chumrah, and I couldn't understand it from, like, a Shulchan Aruch perspective. I really couldn't. And, you know, I asked him, I called him up, because this was becoming a bit of an issue in terms of being able to make the shrita happen, that wasn't really b'chdei shi'as to take into account what he wanted to, and I couldn't figure out any halachic reasoning for it. And he told me straight out on the phone, he said, you know, no, he says, this isn't Shulchan Aruch. And he says, I eat shritas, because I asked him, I said, nobody in Eretz Yisrael is makna, it's not the Eid HaRedis, not any hashgacha that I'm aware of. So, you know, what do you eat when you come to Eretz Yisrael? He said, no, it's not a halachic issue, and I would eat hashgacha that aren't makna. But this is what sells by me in you know, Williamsburg and Borough Park, is that I can say that I have this chumrah that nobody else has.
Marketing.
So sometimes I might be able to admit to you, yeah, so some of it's marketing. That's definitely true. Sometimes there are legitimate disagreements between paiskim, meaning you know there are various paiskim, chashuva paiskim. You know, those the hashgachas that you mentioned, I think all have chashuva paiskim that are involved in them, that were involved in them in the past, etc. Beishem Hashem Baaretz Hema, and you know, they're very chashuva paiskim, and that paskim may be differently about certain shilas. You might have a difference between two shlitas because one rav, one paisik, and one shlita feels that maybe something is an issue, and the other rav feels that it's not an issue. But I don't know that means that, you know, to say that they're a huge difference in terms of the level of kashrus or something like that. You know, to go a step further, there was a big personality in shlita night show. It was Nifter not long ago. He wrote a number of svarim in shlita. Just to avoid politics, I'm not going to mention his name because he worked for one of the Badatsim. And somebody told me in one of the Shlachtism where this Badat Shecht, and there's other Badatsim at Shecht, and there's a Rabbanut at Shecht, and there's obviously Rabbanut Shechitas there also. So he told me that he used to go, this Shechita was considered to be one of the frumish Shechitas, but he told me he would always go ask this Rab from this very frum Badats, who was known for being extremely machmir, he would go and ask him all the shailas in the kashrut for the kashrut regila. Because of a maisa, he was also the biggest makel, meaning that he understood very, very well. He was a real fachman, a real bal mikzaya, a real professional. He understood the sugyas in and out. Therefore, he also had his own, you know, personal vendettas and chumras that he kind of came up with. But at the end of the day, when it came to the bare halacha, he kind of knew how to also, you know, be makel and, you know, paskin lamaisa it's kasher. So again, trace and kasher are big terms to use. But are the differences? There are probably differences. If you're as an outsider, when you look at the differences, they're minor. Even an outsider who understands the difference are generally minor, and it's hard, sometimes hard to say. You know, this bedatzis chumrah is more important than the other bedatzis chumrah, or this kula from this bedatzis is a bigger kula than the kula from the other bedatz. Generally, you know, I think the tzibur does a good job at thinning out the better bedatzim from the lesser bedatzim, and you know, that's I can't comment more in terms of particular bedatzim.
Right. So when it comes, you mentioned the Raman, the Shulchan Aruch before. So when it comes to an Ashkenazi eating from a Sephardi Shechita or the reverse, are those more fundamental issues, or are those also not very significant differences?
Okay. I mean, the differences between Sephardi Glat and Ashkenazi Shaglat are, you know, there are differences since, you know, I'm not going to say time immemorial, but since the time of the Mechaber Rama, at least. I mean, it's really a little bit earlier, but it's a shaila in terms of how, I guess, you know, machmir, if you want to use that term. Nowadays, most shittas that are chalak based yosef, glat based yosef, are going to be also for Ashkenaz with the chumas of the Ramah and the chumas of the Mechaber, so that everybody can eat them without any doubt or question. In terms of when something doesn't fit the bill for either Ashkenazim or Sfaradim, the word trace is a big word. Kasheli ma'od la'amim. It's very, very difficult it's really difficult to say. You know, you have machloksim between the shayim, between the Ran and the Rashi and Teirus Abayis. And the Mechaber or the Ramah Paskins like the Teirus Abayis or like the Ran. And the Achrayim say that you should be chayshish for the other day, but b'shas atchak, you can be saimach on the other day, right? It's Erev Shabbos, or it's you have Archim, all sorts of scenarios that we're familiar with that you could be saimach on a more mako day. It's very hard to say that especially when we're talking about things which are shilos and shilos, which is really what glat is. To say that you wouldn't be that an Ashkenazi wouldn't be samech on the Beis Yosef, to say that within the crevices wouldn't be fine, or to say that the Sfaradim can't be samech on Ashkenazim, the bedikas of the reason, would be very shocking thing to say. You know, whether it's the Mechaber or the Ramah on a higher pedestal than the Ramah, than the Rashbo. Or the Ran, or the Riff, or the Rambam. You know, it would be.
But the question is, how about on the Lechatchila basis?
No, so on the Lechatchila basis, you know, there's a difference, and that's because of a Messiah, because of a minute. There's a minute to it, and it's a Messiah, and I think that Minhagim, which are attached to Halacha, because of this Teresh Baal Peh this essential in Teresh Baal Peh, that Messiah is quite essential to Teresh Baal Peh. So definitely on a lechatchila level and on what's nog, they definitely would have to be marked for what their Messiah is. But in terms of a b'di'evit situation, and a b'di'evit situation doesn't have to be so far-fetched. And as I've heard from Rav Ovadia's sons, both from Rav Avraham Yosef, the Rav of Chulon, and from Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the Rishon LeZion, the Rav Rashi, that his father would eat in restaurants in America that had OU Ashkacha, the Bishul wasn't Bishul Yisrael through the Beis Yosef, was Bishul Yisrael through the Ramah, and the meat wasn't necessarily Chalak Beis Yosef. He didn't even ask about it. And when they asked him about it, he said, it's Minhag HaMakom here, and therefore he can eat it.
That's a story. That's great. That's a great story. Hey, let me go on to the last story I wanted to get some input on, is Basar Shen Yisalem Min Ayin, which is if you turn your back on your meat or you leave it unattended, then you can't assume that it's kosher. And two particular questions. Barbecuing, you leave your meat on the grill, assume it's outside, or maybe inside it, same thing, and you go back 5 minutes, 10 minutes later to check on it and flip it over. So can you assume that it's the same meat? Do you have a palm buster and shini salam in mind? Does it depend if there was a cover on the grill or not? And also a similar but maybe a different question. You leave home and you have your hamburgers in your oven, or maybe you have even frozen meat in your freezer and you left your non-Jewish cleaning help there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 3 hours. Can we assume it's the same meat, or do we really have a problem with basar shini salam yunai and then we wouldn't be able to eat it?
Yeah. You know, so there's actually really two elements here. You know, basar shini salam yunai is a din from the Gemara, and it's a Gemara in Chulin from Rav, and it's a little bit of a chiddush to a certain extent. That meat that's unintended, like you mentioned, you're not allowed to eat it. It needs to be watched over. It needs to be sealed. Something needs to be there. And the mashmaus there is that even in somewhat of a far-fetched circumstance, and the reason why was that it's bad some chumra yaseiro, so to speak, an excessive chumra that Rabin acted with regard to meat, in order that people should actually be more careful because it's an area of concern. And, you know, whether somebody switches your apple, which is ma'oser, with the apple, it's not ma'oser, you're talking about, you know, price difference. So what do they throw out, 100th? It's 1% difference in price, right? But when you're talking about meat, the difference can be immense, right? We all know about all sorts of stories historically between with butchers, with meat processing facilities, et cetera, where they were less than scrupulous, unfortunately, with selling not kosher meat. And it's because it's a tremendous rate of harm. There's a big, big, big price difference. So Mamela, we have to approach it with a slightly different background, but it's a slightly different type of view. The truth is that on a barbecue grill, in a scenario where it's extremely unlikely that an animal would have come to exchange it and put it back in the exact same place, another piece of meat. And there is a chash that an animal will eat one piece of meat and drag in another piece of meat. But in a scenario where it's mamish in the same place, right, again, this is my colleague between the Babli, the Ushalmi, Rav, Levi, et cetera. But in a scenario where it's highly, highly unlikely that the animal would be able to take it off the grill, and put another piece of meat back on the grill, l'chayr, you wouldn't have to be chayshish. But it's a different basar shini salam min ha'ayin, or chayshish for an animal, to a certain extent, than when you're chayshish for a person. If you have meat in your house, and whether it's that you have a guy doing work in your house, whether it's that you rented out your house for a week, you know, you did an Airbnb rental when you flew off to America for a month, and a guy came and stayed in your house, etc. Every scenario might be different because of the svaris that we have to say that why it would be there and that it's identifiable as being the same meat, and why maybe it would be able to be changed. And so it's, you know, it's hard to give an across-the-board answer for all scenarios. But usually in your house, if it's a regular scenario where you're living in your house, it's not going to be such a problem with, you know, having, let's say, garisha help, a cleaning lady, a maid, whether she's a living or not, because there's a constant mirsis. She knows that at any moment anybody can show up, and that you're scrupulous about your kashrus. You never buy anything that's not kosher. So let's say you open up a pack of, you know, whether it's schnitzels or polkies or whatever it is, and you split the package into two, and you put the other package, so it came with a chayisim on it, packed up the way that it needs to be. And now you open it up, there's no machaisim on it, you put it in a Ziploc bag, and you put half of it in the fridge or the freezer, and the other half you use. So usually, you know, it's not something that you really have to be chayshish for. There's going to be any problems with it, even when you leave the house for, you know, extended period of time, for a few hours or for something like that, because they're unlikely going to switch it, use it. They're sensitive to the fact that you keep kosher, and they know there's a real mirsis because you can come at any point in time and they work for you. They want their job, they work for you, et cetera. So, you know, different situations may vary, but if you have somebody They're new in your house. They don't know Minhag Yisrael. They're not familiar with all the kosher thing. They know you're going away for a day or for 2 days, and you left a half a package of schnitzel in the fridge, you know, of raw chicken breast in the fridge. You leave it there. You come back, and you find what looks to be the same amount of, you know, the raw chicken breast, roughly. There might be a real bona fide problem because you left it there unattended. They're not sensitive to it. They didn't know you might come back at any point in time, et cetera. And this, you know, you can't. It's not really that identifiable. You didn't pay that much attention. It's not that you wrapped it up in a very specific type of way. You just stuck it in a Ziploc bag. They were hungry. They wanted to make themselves grilled chicken. You might have shout-outs about kashering or kalim. That's a whole different story. There might be various attempts to be mitzvah. They definitely didn't use all your kalim, so you don't know which kli. Even if they used it, it wasn't a ben. It's probably not a ben yayim right now, et cetera. There's all sorts of terufim from a halachic vantage point that you can be mitzvah, maybe to be mekel. But you might have all sorts of shiles in such a scenario. But certainly with that chicken, it would be advisable not to use that chicken in such a scenario. So it all depends on the precise scenarios. If you left meat unattended outside, unwrapped, you know, kind of on your porch, and you were leaving it not on the grill, and you plopped it down in the middle of the table, you didn't pay attention exactly where you left it on the table, and you leave it there for 45 minutes, and you come back, even though you have a fence around your backyard, so you're not worried about, you know, your nosy Gaius neighbor coming in and switching the meat because it looks really hot and really tasty to them, that you still might have to worry about an animal in that scenario because you don't have anything to, you know, any real smart to say. It's just to say that it's unlikely. I don't have tons of raccoons in my backyard or tons of cats in my backyard. If they sometimes could come in, you already might have an issue.
Right, and at work, if you walk out of your office for 20 minutes and you left your sandwich there, it could be also a fish sandwich, tuna fish sandwich, or meat, chicken, whatever it may be, and you walk away and you have a conversation with someone 10, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and you have a roommate or something, your secretary goes around, maybe then you have a problem also.
Okay, so, you know, that could vary also on certain scenarios. If you have a siman muvhak not to the sandwich, because you know, I think I read an article that you wrote, or a piece that you wrote in one of your books, about a similar scenario. You bring a story with somebody on an airplane, where the fellow sitting next to him, when he got up to use the bathroom, the fellow switched a piece of his pastrami for his pastrami. It depends on how much of a siman muvhak you have. If you know your wife made a very specific type of meat on Shabbos and it's the leftovers, you know the exact shade, the exact cut. Then when you come back and it's very clearly the piece of meat your wife made, so you know it's you probably don't have any problems. Likewise, some salmon and it's quite clear salmon is without having the fins or scales. Most pikes can maintain that it's because of its very specific unique color that's enough of a simmon. So you come back and you see that you have a piece of lox in your sandwich and it's definitely a piece of lox. So, you don't have to necessarily worry about it. If it's something more complicated and there's no siman muvhak on it, mushed up tuna, basically, tuna mixed with mayonnaise or something like that, there's nothing muvhak about it, that it could have been, anybody's tuna salad they put instead and the roll is, exactly the same and you can't tell if the roll was played with or not because it's stuck anyway in a bag crumpled up in your briefcase for who knows how long before you took it out and it's hard to really tell how much it was tampered with, how much not. So then it wouldn't really, then you might again be in a situation of not having simanim. But, if it's something that's very clear, you have a real tsiyasayin on it, it's yours, it's the way you brought it, you know this piece of meat, you know this piece of chicken or piece of fish or whatever it is, or cheese, that should certainly be fine though.
Right, very good. Rabbi Krakowski, thank you for all these insights and, it's delightful to have you on the show for the first time, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Okay, it was my pleasure, and again, it's always a pleasure having you as a neighbor. So even if I'm not on the show, I'm always happy, I guess, post-corona when we get to see each other a little bit more in show, to be able to hear all your little snippets and your ha'aris and sugis b'halacha. Differences, they're minor. Even an outsider who understands the difference are generally minor, and it's hard, sometimes hard to say, you know, this bedatz is chumrah is more important than the other bedatz is chumrah, or this kula from this bedatz is a bigger kula than the kula from the other bedatz. Generally, you know, I think the tzibur does a good job at thinning out the better bedatzim from the lesser bedatzim, and I can't comment more in terms of particular bedatzim.
Right. So when it comes, you mentioned the Raman, the Shulchan Aruch before. So when it comes to an Ashkenazi eating from a Sephardi Shechita or the reverse, are those more fundamental issues, or are those also not very significant differences?
Okay. I mean, the differences between Sephardi Glatt and Ashkenazi Glatt are, you know, there are differences since, you know, I'm not going to say time immemorial, but since the time of the Mechaber and Ramah, at least. I mean, it's really a little bit earlier, that's him. But it's a shayla in terms of how, I guess, you know, machmer, if you want to use that term. Nowadays, most shittas that are chalak based yaisus, glot based yaisus, are going to be also for Ashkenaz with the chumas of the Ramah and the chumas of the Mechaber, so that everybody can eat them without any doubt or question. In terms of when something doesn't fit the bill for either Ashkenazim or Sfaradim, the word trace is a big word. Kasheli ma'od la'amim. It's very, very difficult it's really difficult to say. You know, you have machloksim between the Shainim, between the Ran and the Rashba and Teres Abayis. And the Mechaber or the Ramah Paskins like the Teres Abayis or like the Ran. And the Achronim say that you should be chayshish for the other day, but b'shas atchak, you can be saimach on the other day, right? It's Erev Shabbos, or it's you have Archim, all sorts of scenarios that we're familiar with that you could be saimach on a more mako day. It's very hard to say that especially when we're talking about things which are shilos and shilos, which is really what glat is. To say that you wouldn't be that an Ashkenazi wouldn't be samech on the Beis Yosef, to say that what's in the crevices wouldn't be fine, or to say that the Sfaradim can't be samech on the Ashkenazim, the bedikas of the reason, would be very shocking thing to say. You know, whether it's the Mechaber or the Ramah on a higher pedestal than the Ramah or than the Rashba. Or the Ran, or the Riff, or the Rambam. You know, it would be.
But the question is, how about on the Lechatchila basis?
No, so on the Lechatchila basis, you know, there's a difference, and that's because of a Messiah, because of a minute. There's a minute to it, and it's a Messiah, and I think that Minhagim, which are attached to Halacha, because of this Teresh Baal Peh this essential in Teresh Baal Peh. That Masorah is quite essential to Teresh Baal Peh. So definitely on a Lechatchila level and on what's Nog, they definitely would have to be marked for what their Masorah is. But in terms of a B'di'evit situation, and a B'di'evit situation doesn't have to be so far-fetched. And as I've heard from Rav Ovadia's sons, both from Rav Abraham Yosef, the Rav of Chulon, and from Rav Yitzchak Yosef, the Rishon LeTzion, the Rav Rashi, that his father would eat in restaurants in America, that had OU Ashkacha, the Bishul wasn't Bishul Yisrael, either Beis Yosef was Bishul Yisrael, either Ramah, and the meat wasn't necessarily Chalak Beis Yosef. He didn't even ask about it. And when they asked him about it, he said, it's Minhag HaMakom here, and therefore he can eat it.
That's a story. That's great. That's a great story. Hey, let me go on to the last area I wanted to get some input on, is Basar Sheni Salam Min Ayin, which is if you turn your back on your meat or you leave it unattended, then you can't assume that it's kosher. And two particular questions. Barbecuing, you leave your meat on the grill, assume it's outside, or maybe inside, it's the same thing, and you go back 5 minutes, 10 minutes later to check on it and flip it over. So can you assume that it's the same meat? Do you have a problem with basar and shinis alam in ayin? Does it depend if there was a cover on the grill or not? And also a similar but maybe a different question, you leave home and you have your hamburgers in your oven, or maybe you have even frozen meat in your freezer and you left your non-Jewish cleaning help there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 3 hours. Can we assume it's the same meat, or do we really have a problem with basar sheni salam min ayin and we wouldn't be able to eat it?
Yeah. So there's actually really two elements here. You know, Basu Shiratam and Ayin is a din from the Gemara, and it's a Gemara in Chulin from Rav, and it's a little bit of a chiddush to a certain extent. That meat that's unintended, like you mentioned, you're not allowed to eat it. It needs to be watched over. It needs to be sealed. Something needs to be there. And the mashmois there is that even in somewhat of a far-fetched circumstance, and the reason why was that it's bad from a chumra yisero, so to speak, an excessive chumra that Rabin acted with regard to meat, in order that people should actually be more careful because it's an area of concern. And, you know, whether somebody switches your apple, which is ma'oser, with the apple it's not ma'oser, you're talking about, you know, price difference. So what do they throw out, 100th? It's 1% difference in price, right? But when you're talking about meat, the difference can be immense, right? We all know about all sorts of stories historically between with butchers, with meat processing facilities, et cetera, where they were less than scrupulous, unfortunately, with selling not kosher meat. And it's because it's a tremendous rate of harm. There's a big, big, big price difference. So Mamela, we have to approach it with a slightly different background, it's a slightly different type of view. The truth is that on a barbecue grill, in a scenario where it's extremely unlikely that an animal would have come to exchange it and put it back in the exact same place, another piece of meat, now, there is a chash that an animal will eat one piece of meat and drag in another piece of meat. But in a scenario where it's mamish in the same place, again, this is my colleague's team, the Babli, the Ushalmi, Rav, Levi, etc. But in a scenario where it's highly, highly unlikely that the animal would be able to take it off the grill, and put another piece of meat back on the grill, l'chayr, you wouldn't have to be chayshish. But it's a different basis in a salam and a ayin, or a chayshish for an animal, to a certain extent, than when you're chayshish for a person. If you have meat in your house, and you, whether it's that you have a guy doing work in your house, whether it's that you rented out your house for a week, you know, you did an Airbnb rental when you flew off to America for a month, and a guy came and stayed in your house, etc. Every scenario might be different because of the svaris that we have to say that why it would be there, and that it's identifiable as being the same meat, and why maybe it would be able to be changed. And so, you know, it's hard to give an across-the-board answer for all scenarios. But usually in your house, if it's a regular scenario where you're living in your house, it's not going to be such a problem with, you know, having, let's say, Garisha help, a cleaning lady, a maid, whether she's a live-in or not, because there's a constant mirsus. She knows that at any moment anybody can show up, and that you're scrupulous about your kashrus. You never buy anything that's not kosher. So if you open up a pack of, whether it's schnitzels or polkies or whatever it is, and you split the package into two, and you put the other package that came with a chayisim on it, packed up the way that it needs to be, and now you open it up, there's no more chayisim on it, you put it in a Ziploc bag, and you put half of it in the fridge or the freezer, and the other half you use. So usually, you know, it's not something that you really have to be chayshish for. There's going to be any problems with it, even when you leave the house for, you know, extended period of time, for a few hours or something like that, because they're unlikely going to switch it, use it. They're sensitive to the fact that you keep kosher, and they know there's a real mirsus because you can come at any point in time and they work for you. They want their job, they work for you, etc. So, you know, different situations might vary, but if you have somebody, they're new in your house, they don't know Minhag Yisrael, they're not familiar with all the kashrus thing, they know you're going away for a day or for 2 days, and you left a half a package of schnitzels in the fridge, you know, of raw chicken breast in the fridge, you leave it there, you come back and you find what looks to be the same amount of, you know, raw chicken breast roughly, there might be a real bona fide problem because you left it there unattended, they're not sensitive to it, they didn't know you might come back at any point in time, etc. And this, you know, you can't, it's not really that identifiable. You didn't pay that much attention. It's not that you wrapped it up in a very specific type of way. You just stuck it in a Ziploc bag. They were hungry. They wanted to make themselves grilled chicken. You might have shy off about kashering your kalim. That's a whole different story. There might be various attempts to be mitzvah. They definitely didn't use all your kalim, so you don't know which kli. Even if they used it, it wasn't a ben. It's probably not a ben yaim right now, etc. There's all sorts of terufim from a halachic vantage point that you can be mitzvah, maybe to be mekel, but you might have all sorts of shiles in such a scenario. But certainly with that chicken, it would be advisable not to use that chicken in such a scenario. So it all depends on the precise scenarios. If you left meat unattended outside, unwrapped, kind of on your porch, and you were leaving it not on the grill, and you plopped it down in the middle of the table, you didn't pay attention exactly where you left it on the table, and you leave it there for 45 minutes, and you come back, even though you have a fence around your backyard, so you're not worried about your nosy guy or your neighbor coming in and switching the meat because it looks really hot and really tasty to them. That you still might have to worry about an animal in that scenario because you don't have anything to, any real smart to say. It's just to say that it's unlikely. I don't have tons of raccoons in my backyard or tons of cats in my backyard. If they sometimes could come in, you already might have an issue.
Right, and at work, if you walk out of your office for 20 minutes and you left your sandwich there, it could be also a fish sandwich, tuna fish sandwich, or meat, chicken, whatever it may be, and you walk away and you have a conversation with someone 10, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and you have a roommate or something, your secretary goes around, maybe then you have a problem also.
Okay, so, that could vary also on certain scenarios. If you have a siman muvhak to, not to the sandwich, because, I think I read an article that you wrote, or a piece that you wrote in one of your books, about, a similar scenario, and you bring a story with somebody on an airplane, where the fellow sitting next to him, when he got up to use the bathroom, the fellow switched the piece of, his pastrami for his pastrami. It depends on how much of a siman muvhak you have. If your wife made a very specific type of meat on Shabbos and it's the leftovers, the exact shade, the exact cut, then you come back and it's very clearly the piece of meat your wife made. So, you probably don't have any problems. Likewise, some salmon and it's quite clear salmon is without having the fins or scales. Most pikes can maintain that it's because of its very specific unique color that's enough of a simon. So you come back and you see that you have a piece of lox in your sandwich, and it's definitely a piece of lox. So you don't have to necessarily worry about it. If it's something more complicated and there's no siman muvhak on it, just mushed up tuna basically, tuna mixed with mayonnaise or something like that. There's nothing muvhak about it, that it could have been anybody's tuna salad they put instead, and the roll is exactly the same, and you can't tell if the roll was played with or not because it's stuck anyway in a bag crumpled up in your briefcase for who knows how long before you took it out, and it's hard to really tell how much it was tampered with, how much not. So then it wouldn't really, then you might again be in a situation of not having simanim. But, if it's something that's very clear, you have a real TSI on it, it's yours, it's the way you brought it, this piece of meat, this piece of chicken or piece of fish or whatever it is, or cheese, that should certainly be fine though.
Right, very good. Rabbi Krakowski, thank you for all these insights, and it's delightful to have you on the show for the first time, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
Okay, it was my pleasure, and again, it's always a pleasure having you as a neighbor. So even if it's not on the show, I'm always happy, I guess, post-corona when we get to see each other a little bit more in show, to be able to hear all your little snippets and your ha'aris and sugis b'halacha.